I'm going to turn the show over to Melissa Friedland, who's the Superfund Redevelopment Program Manager, and she's going to get the show started. Thanks.
Thanks, Michelle. Everybody, I'm on slide 3. I want to say good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for joining us. I'm very happy that we're able to offer this program today. And if you've tuned into any of our other webinars, you'll know that Superfund sites have been used for a variety of purposes. But today, we're going to learn about how sites are being reused for commercial purposes and how that influences local economies and makes a real difference in communities. So I'm very pleased that Tom McKittrick from ReVenture Park is here, Vivienne Valance from The Point, and Jay Whisker from Vertac have all agreed to join us. They're going to talk about what these sites meant to communities before Superfund, how they made reuse happen, and how their efforts are paying off today. So I'm moving on to slide 4, and I want to start just by giving you a little overview of what Superfund redevelopment means. And our mission at both the national and regional level is to work with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. Reuse is not new. Communities have been reusing cleaned up sites for many years. And EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but it wasn't until 1999 that the agency officially launched the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, or SRI. And SRI works to develop tools for site stakeholders to help promote reuse, and we work with regions to provide site-specific assistance. I'm going on to slide 5. We see reuse and protectiveness as going hand in hand, in case anyone is wondering why EPA cares about reuse, because we've learned that understanding the future use of sites plays a key role in picking the right cleanups. Having stewards using and taking care of properties helps EPA make sure that sites stay safe. Reuse can also provide communities with opportunities to bring in local jobs, reuse infrastructure, and preserve valuable green fields. Moving on to slide 6. A lot of people do think jobs when they hear redevelopment, and new commercial, industrial, and other uses that bring jobs to communities are definitely important, especially today. But we see many reuses, and if you look on this slide, you'll see a general list of what we've seen. I like to say that we haven't come to the end of the kinds of reuse that we're likely to see. Every once in a while, I get really surprised, and I like that. But for more on measuring success and the economics and what we're talking about today, I want to turn it over to Frank Avasato, who's the project officer for Superfund Redevelopment and manages our Superfund Redevelopment contract and spearheads our case studies and videos and regional support. So, Frank, you want to take over with slide 7?
Okay. Thanks, Melissa. I just wanted to talk briefly about how we measure success at the reuse sites that Melissa had talked about. Many reuse outcomes can play a role in economically revitalizing a community by providing on-site jobs and providing economic opportunities. We currently capture economic benefits at Superfund sites in 3 different ways. First, SRI tracks general estimates on the numbers of on-site jobs, income from jobs, and sales revenue data for a number of sites in retail, commercial, or industrial reuse to give a general overview of the national impacts associated with Superfund redevelopment. On your slide, you can see there's 5, in the blue box, there's 5 different items listed. We talked about on-site jobs, annual employment income from on-site jobs, on-site property value information, property tax revenues, and other economic impacts that are unique to each individual site. Secondly, SRI performs what we call our local impact case studies that allow for a site-specific approach to gathering more complete information related to reuse, employment, and other economic impacts. And then thirdly, communities sometimes provide EPA with economic information during the redevelopment of in-depth case studies, which is highlighted in these reports. I'm going to move on to slide number 8. Slide number 8 presents, it's a table that presents a national estimate of over 140 sites that we are tracking where on-site businesses are providing local jobs. You can see that we're currently tracking 299 businesses with annual sales of $8.8 billion, over 25,000 jobs, and annual employment income of over $1.6 billion. You want to know where we get this information from. Well, we use readily available internet and database sources to create estimates of national totals related to economic impacts of Superfund sites and reuse. We believe that this is an underestimate because all of the sites at each individual site, we do not know all of the business names and addresses located on site, and sites are constantly losing businesses and gaining businesses, so it's kind of tough to track. But we have many other sites. We have over 500 sites that we're currently tracking and reuse, so we believe that we will continue to add information to this table. Moving on to slide number 9, this is the local economic impact fact sheets. Local impact case studies gather more complete information related to reuse, employment, and other economic impacts. Listed here we have the current impact studies, and these can, there's a website located down below at the bottom of the slide. If you go to that link, it'll take you to a number of these case studies that are listed here and also some of the upcoming case studies. You'll notice that we're talking about two of the sites that are located on this page. While national economic impact estimates may underestimate jobs, local impact case studies can obtain detailed information about economic benefits for every company present on the site, in addition to unique benefits provided by particular uses, such as alternative energy. Each of the local impact case studies includes a technical appendix that also provides an overview of the approaches, assumptions, and methodologies used to obtain estimates on local economic benefits. And once again, I encourage you to visit our website to learn more about these sites. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Melissa, where she'll pick up on slide 10.
Okay, thanks, Frank. This map is an overview of those sites where we're aware that there's new or ongoing commercial and industrial use broken down by EPA regions. And in the next couple of slides, I'm just going to highlight a couple of those not covered by our other presenters to set the tone for how Superfund reuse can improve the economies of communities. So now I'm on slide 11, and I'd like to talk about McGillis and Gibbs. The city of New Brighton, Minnesota has a rich agricultural and industrial heritage, and the city's been working for a long time to diversify its economy and housing and is looking for ways to revitalize vacant property and especially the communities downtown. And the McGillis and Gibbs Bell Lumber and Coal Company Superfund site provided a significant opportunity to expand the city's limited commercial office and retail areas, as well as providing acreage for larger manufacturing and distribution businesses. So in 1986, the city developed a plan to revitalize the old Highway 8 corridor, which was a historic road that was once a main route through the Twin Cities. And redevelopment of the 25-acre McGillis and Gibbs portion of the site was one of the plan's linchpins, with an emphasis on mixed-use development that would provide a community amenities and address multiple community priorities. So we can, if you want, take some time later on and look at the increases that we've seen. Moving on to slide 12, I want to talk briefly about Murray Smelter, which is a great example of public service reuse, housing a medical center, a transit station, and a large retail store. And today, a portion of the property is currently home to a station for the Utah Transit Authority's Transit Express, which is a two-line light rail system providing easier access to Salt Lake City. And also operating on the property is a retail membership warehouse club and the Intermountain Medical Center, which opened in 2007. And the hospital serves as the main referral center for several surrounding states and healthcare institutions. And I'm going to move on to slide 13. And the top photograph here shows abandoned vehicles at the former Abrajona Auto Parts property before redevelopment, and the bottom photograph shows the new skating rink, which is there now. So until the early 2000s, one property within the Wells G&H Superfund site which was the former auto parts property, was home to an auto dismantling facility, and it spread across 6.5 acres. And in 2002, a developer purchased the property and proposed plans to transform much of it into an ice skating arena. And EPA worked with a new owner in the city to provide them with the information on the environmental conditions necessary to support the planning and permitting process. So the new owner has since cleared the junkyard of dismantled cars, built a new ice skating arena on the property, and we now have successful reuse and continued use. The Abergona Auto Parts property is providing jobs and enhancing the city's tax base. The new ice arena is also providing enhanced recreational opportunities for area residents, and it helps fulfill a cultural need for a community and a region that places a high value on the sport of ice hockey. And I'm going to move on now to slide 14. I hope that the brief overview has started to paint a picture of how these sites are contributing to the economic fabric of communities. But now I'm very excited to hand this over to Tom McKittrick of Foresight Development, who's going to share with us a very ambitious and inspiring reuse plan at ReVenture Park. And after Tom's presentation, we can take some questions. So, Tom, it's over to you.
Well, Melissa, thank you for that. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you about what we're doing in Charlotte with ReVenture Park. I'm on slide 16, and just probably appropriate to give you just a quick background on the property, some history. A former textile dye manufacturing facility was known within the EPA as the Martin Marietta Sadeco site. It was started in 1935 and ceased dye operations in 2005. In 1985, a Swiss-owned chemical conglomerate, Clariant Corporation, acquired the property, and with it, all of the environmental remediation responsibilities. Since 85, they have spent upwards of $40 million remediating the property, and that's a lot of the hard work's done, but there's still a substantial amount of remediation left to do on the site. There was 1,000 jobs there at one time, and it's, you know, it's 667 acres. It's the largest section of heavy industrial real estate in the metro Charlotte region. We mentioned here we're talking about Superfund sites today. We actually were successful in having this site delisted from Superfund in earlier this year through the Herculean efforts of many within the EPA. We'll talk about that in a moment. On slide 17, so basically our plan, we're a private developer, and our thought with this site when we took it on almost 4 years ago was there's an incredible amount of infrastructure here associated with this property. The idea it was and is to reposition that infrastructure to recreate or to create a platform for attracting large-scale energy, alternative fuel, you know, recycling-type projects. We'll call that, you know, an eco-industrial park, if you will. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about today is really through that lens of recycling one of these sites into an eco-industrial park. On slide 18, this shows you some additional acreage that we have recently added to the project. You can see there's another 578 acres of land that surrounds this property that we now control. It was entitled for 3,000 residential units and mixed-use commercial back in 07, came online in 08. So obviously that point, those plans have been installed, but the ultimate plan here is to create a residential community around the industrial park in the entire area, really being focused on environmental responsibility and stewardship, if you will. The ultimate goal would be to create baseload power on the industrial site and, you know, power all of the surrounding homes with renewable energy, a microgrid. I'm on slide 19. It's, you know, a private developer, we got to focus on how do we drive value, how do we create value, you know, on the project and in the community. This gives you a list of some of the things that we're working on. But one of the big ones I mentioned, delisting, we felt that delisting was necessary for a lot of reasons. The site has been managed by the RCRA, under the RCRA program. It's somewhat unusual for a site to be in both RCRA and Superfund, so we started working with EPA to delist from Superfund. I probably have no idea how many people actually worked on that project, but there was a lot of folks involved, and we were successful, and it's, you know, a huge success, and really set the trajectory for the site that allows us to get a brownfield agreement through North Carolina, which provides new tenants, you know, absolute liability protection from any, you know, contamination on the property. One of the big areas, you know, trying to focus on attracting renewable energy projects to the site, this is, by its nature, a very expensive site to develop on. We created a piece of legislation that gives this property a 3x REC multiplier, which some of you may or may not know what that means, but REC is renewable energy credits. There are 30 states in the U.S. that have some form of a law that requires the utilities to buy a certain percentage of their electrons from renewable energy. North Carolina is the only southeastern state with that provision. And how the utilities are graded on their compliance is by renewable energy credits. So this site creates three times the renewable energy credits on the first 20 megawatts of power. And really what that's doing is it's given some additional economic incentive that makes a biomass project economically viable, you know, on a site that's, again, very expensive to develop. So power generation, you know, some of the other ways, I won't get into all this, but we have an existing wastewater treatment plant. We're taking that offline. We actually sold our phosphorus and nitrogen allocation from that plant to the city of Charlotte. They're proposing a new $200 million wastewater treatment plant on this site, and we're selling them 185 acres of land for that facility and a portion of our nutrient allocation. A lot of that money is getting plowed back into the ongoing remediation. There's a variety of other ways that we're driving value out there, you know, which includes leasing space to new companies and recycling some of the metal out of those existing buildings and whatnot. I'm on slide 20 now. We talk about clean energy, and that's a core focus for the project. We're under construction on a 4.5 megawatt biomass combined heat and power project. There are a variety of other renewable projects that are in various stages of negotiation, if you will. One in particular I'll point out is this algae to transportation fuel company. There's a company in South Carolina that's actually creating transportation fuel from algae. They loved a lot of what we're trying to create with ReVenture and saw a lot of some fantastic synergies, and they're moving their operation to ReVenture, and there's a lot of closed loop type scenarios that we'll be working on with them. And that's one of several. There's also working on a solar project, and recycling, I would tell you, is becoming a huge focus on the site. Being I2, recycling is a use by right, and there are a variety of recycling related endeavors that are in various stages. Next slide is 21. Trying to create an environment that's conducive to entrepreneurs. We've got 350,000 square feet of existing space on this property. We're in the process of cleaning out all of those buildings and recycling the metal and getting that into just generic space. What we found is there's just an inordinate amount of small startup companies that need inexpensive, dry industrial space, and especially if they're in recycling or energy, they love the idea of commingling and being around like-minded firms. So lots of activity there. We have the ability to make space available for them for not a lot of money, and it's becoming a big part of what we're doing. And then, you know, that last bullet, industrial ecology, is a term that is starting to be used. It's basically concepts where it's we're creating closed loop environments where one company's waste stream is another firm's feedstock, and waste heat is being utilized amongst the parties and so forth. If you focus exclusively on these renewable or clean energy type projects on one site, there's tend to be a lot of closed loop opportunities. One of the other, I'm on slide 22 now, educational initiatives. We thought it was incredibly important to bring the academic community in to the extent we can. We're working with UNC on a variety of endeavors. There's a partnership with the adjacent elementary and middle schools to create a working farm and community garden on property that we're donating. We're donating a 12,000 square foot office building that a group is using to teach STEM curriculum to local teachers, and on and on. We're also working with UNC on some forward-thinking master planning with respect to the residential component. So partnerships with the educational community is very important. I'm on slide 23 now. Education is important. Environmental stewardship is obviously the most critical element of this whole project. This is a contaminated site, so everything we're doing out here has to be in harmony, if you will, with the environment. There's some pictures of either actual pictures of birds on site. The site manager, we had some pictures taken early on that had photoshopped deer in there. He went crazy. So these are real pictures. That is a bald eagle on top. And on the right, it's an osprey nesting platform. There are seven nesting platforms along the perimeter of the site. There's 1.5 miles of river frontage, and the wildlife habitat on this site is truly remarkable. I can't tell you that I know the name of the other two birds, but I'm on slide 24 now, kind of carrying through on the environmental side. We created a 177-acre conservation easement, which basically all of the water frontage is put into an easement. It can never be disturbed. It will be protected in perpetuity. We've also partnered with the North Carolina Wildlife Federation, and we've achieved a WAIT certification, Wildlife and Industry Together. And basically that means there's a variety of habitat enhancement type projects that we're working on in the easements primarily, and lots of trails. The Carolina Thread Trail is connecting through our site and is the first leg of a 15-county trail system that's being developed here in North and South Carolina. Let's see, I'm on slide 25. Wanted to highlight economic development. That's obviously a key critical element on redeveloping any of these sites. We believe with the plan that we've got in place, it is very plausible to attract up to 1,000 jobs here just based on the projects that we have planned or are currently working on. Employment just on the jobs that these new projects that we've inked will be generating are between 35 and 45,000 a year. And again, just on the projects that are under construction on the site, there's $14 million of new investment that's happening as we speak. And we think that can grow, and we hope it grows to obviously many hundreds of millions over time. There's an incredible amount of acreage here. That's obviously going to increase the property taxes revenue for the area. I'm on slide 26. As I mentioned earlier, touched on briefly, we're a private developer. You know, our core focus is buying corporate surplus industrial real estate, primarily in the Southeast. And what we've learned through this process of developing a venture is that there's a real opportunity here to revitalize these sites. And we're actually creating a platform specifically focused on creating eco-industrial parks on shuttered manufacturing complexes. And there's just a multitude of non-traditional value or revenue creation scenarios that can be generated from these properties. We've learned a lot, an incredible amount over the last 4 years, and we're looking to duplicate these sites, hopefully, you know, throughout the country. I'm on slide 27. So the EIP platform, if you will, Eco Industrial Park, typically we're looking for sites that are 500 plus 1,000 square feet on 500 acres. And I will tell you that just spending a little bit of time, there is an immense supply, unfortunately, of these properties. So that's good in one hand, bad in another. It's good that there's a lot of opportunity here. We're looking for sites that have, you know, existing power infrastructure, steam infrastructure. Hopefully they have active air permits. Wastewater treatment plants are a huge benefit. If you're doing energy, electrical interconnection, and heavy electrical infrastructure is a huge benefit. We've seen sites that have deep water ports. And also I would tell you, RPS, you know, states that have an RPS, a renewable portfolio standard, and again, that's one of the law requiring utilities to buy renewable energy, certainly helps if you're going to focus on energy-related projects, that if you're doing those in a state with an RPS. Many times we're looking for companies that want to get these sites off their books, and part of what we're doing is, you know, the liability risk transfer, if you will. We'll take over the remediation, the liability for the site. We're probably getting paid to do that, but we understand how to unwind the environmental issues and work with the EPA and the state regulators to create an environment such that these sites can be repurposed. Slide 28 just gives you an idea of chemical plants, paper mills. You know, heavy manufacturing facilities are what we're typically, a lot of times what we're looking at. And if you look, it is, again, no shortage of opportunities. They're literally everywhere. On slide 29, you know, trends supporting what we're doing and the eco-industrial concept. The U.S. government, the military, a lot of people have heard of the net zero initiative. They are very focused on, you know, having all of their power created from local sources as well as their fuels. That's a big driver in the industry right now. Going on to slide 30. Some additional trends. You know, I think you'll find that certainly the EPA, local regulatory agencies, local governments, county governments are all very focused and supportive of renewable energy. So, or clean energy projects in general. So I think if you're getting ready to take on a site like this, you'll find that there's a lot of support at the government level. Sarbanes-Oxley, we found is, you know, the new, some accounting principles. There are companies that want to get these sites, you know, these liabilities off their books, so that certainly creates some opportunities. And one of the things I would tell you that we're seeing a trend in very heavy manufacturing start to come back towards the United States, and those projects are all looking for sites with heavy infrastructure, so it's again another scenario that helps support the trend. And in most every company, I would tell you, any company of any size, if they're aware at all, they're generally focused on being more sustainable, using less, and using more cleaner energy or cleaner sources of fuel and energy. Skipped over a lot here, but, you know, lessons learned on slide 33. I had 6 pages of lessons learned. I compared it down to 1 in the spirit of time, but I would tell you, you know, hire good consultants and attorneys. Could not stress that enough. If you're taking on the remediation and becoming responsible for it, it is just imperative that you understand what you're getting into. So that's certainly something that we practice. We're typically going forward, we're looking at sites that, you know, we know they're going to be fairly well on their way to being, you know, cash flow positive out of the gate. And that's just an important nuance, especially if you're a private entity. The rebranding, I would tell you, is again, one of the most important things to focus on. These sites often have a stigma. It's, you know, the big shuttered plant that laid off, you know, 3 of my family members, it's contaminated. You have to change the public's perception of the site, and create some new energy around it, if you will, such that you can get the momentum going for the redevelopment. non-traditional value creation. I mean, we talked about nutrient allocations and monetizing those and conservation easements and on and on. There's just a lot of ways to drive value out of one of these sites that is not obvious to a traditional real estate development approach, and would encourage you to really peel the layers back and look for those ways to make these sites viable. The energy projects, if you're going to get into a renewable project you've never done one before, I'll be happy to talk to you. It's not, you know, a simple process. It's very challenging, especially if you're in a regulated utility market. But it certainly can be done, and we encourage that. On the grants and incentives, it's something we need to work on more. There are a lot of dollars out there available to promote these type of projects. It's a complicated process. We certainly need to get smarter about it, and we encourage you to look into that deeply if you're going to do a project like this. And lastly is just, you know, work with the EPA. They are very focused on promoting these, you know, any type of redevelopment that's responsible on these sites. But there's a vast amount of resources within the agency, and I think you'll find a lot of resources and help to get a site redeveloped. So we'd certainly encourage you to do that, and just, you know, to think big, right? I mean, if you're going to do a site, you know, do it in a grand fashion such that it creates a lot of benefit for the community. On slide 32, you know, there's a quote that I like here, but really the message is recycling a shuttered, contaminated industrial site into a hub of energy or clean energy type projects, we believe, is certainly a socially and environmentally responsible, you know, endeavor. And, you know, it's a kind of a rare instance where, you know, public policy, private investment, you know, an environmental stewardship, if you will, intersect, and you know, everyone's interests can be addressed with a project like this. So that's all I have, and again, very much appreciate your time, and happy to answer any questions.
Great, Tom. Thank you. That was a terrific presentation. I have to tell you that the phone lines were ringing from one of our regional coordinators in Region 5 who said, I've got to talk to him because I've got properties he might be interested in. So we're going to send you an email with that information.
Okay.
Tom Bloom, thanks for doing that. I guess, is there anyone on the phone who wants to ask a question for Tom? Okay, there'll be another opportunity later. I guess, Tom, I had a question. How did your own thinking change from, you know, a lot of times you say Superfund, and you did talk about stigma, but you obviously see this as an opportunity instead of something else. So what happened in your thinking that you moved from why would anyone want to be involved with a Superfund site to saying there's a lot we can do here, and this is not what it seems, and this is maybe the future?
Yeah. Good question. I mean, most people, unfortunately, if you mention environmental contamination, they have an automatic recoil reaction, right? They don't want anything to do with it. And the perceived risk of environmental liability is usually, in most instances, substantially greater than the actual risk. And so we embrace that risk and roll up our sleeves to try and figure that out. And what we found is there's not many people that are willing to figure that out, and so therefore it creates opportunities. So to be blunt, I mean, we see opportunity in tackling these sites. And in the Superfund, you know, if you mention environmental contaminated, that's one level of recoil. If you mention Superfund, unfortunately, that's, you know, sometimes another, and we just felt it was important to get the label removed, and it allowed us to get a brownfield agreement in North Carolina. But, you know, Superfund sites are certainly nothing to be, you know, scared of. They can be managed, and in many instances, if you're a local community, you're not going to be responsible for the remediation, so, you know, you really shouldn't have to worry about those subjects.
That's great.
Bill Denman in Region 4, I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator. I just wanted to add for the group, I just wanted to make a couple comments. Tom, I certainly appreciate the kind things you said about EPA and our willingness to work with you, but I also wanted to also let people know that they were very patient and very understanding in working with us. You know, they didn't come in expecting that, you know, we were going to be able to just, you know, deal with this issue overnight. And it actually turned out to be more difficult than even we thought it would be. So it was a lengthy process, and, you know, we certainly appreciate their patience and willingness to stay with the project and not just, you know, throw up their hands in frustration and say we're just going to find somewhere else. You know, for the EPA and regulator people on the phone, I can say the reason Superfund and RCRA were both involved was kind of a legacy of timing. This was one of the earlier listed sites, and so Superfund had done some work on the site before the RCRA corrective action program got up and running, and so you had CERCLA areas and RCRA areas, and it was very complicated, and it was just kind of a relic of how the programs developed and, you know, needed to be corrected, because really RCRA was doing the majority of the work now, and the Superfund part really needed to be clarified, and we were certainly happy to work with them to get that done so we could, you know, get the site positioned for some good redevelopment.
That's great, Bill. Thank you for that. We have another question that's shown up. Tom, someone wants to know, has the city of Charlotte been supportive of this reuse? Do they see what's in it for them, and have they been an important partner, and how has that changed over the last couple of years?
They've clearly been a supportive partner and continue to be. So, yes, in short, they've been very, very supportive. You know, Charlotte's a fairly large metro city, so, you know, this is why. You know, to the extent they can be supportive, they certainly have been. As we look at other sites, we go into smaller communities, and, you know, a smaller community, especially if they have a huge site like this, we've seen instances where, you know, communities will literally part the seas to help you work on a site and transform it. So, in short, yes, Charlotte's been very, very supportive.
Okay, we've got one more question, then we'll move on to our next speaker. Can a measure of economic impact, and Tom, this is not necessarily for you, but it just raises something interesting. Can a measure of economic impact be based on savings generated when reusing land from a petroleum refinery to solar panels and a wind turbine farm? So I would assume, I'm sure the answer is yes. How sophisticated we are as an agency in terms of actually making a dollars and cents calculation, I don't know yet. I'm sure there are some others that could speak to that more than I. Tom, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Well, I would tell you, there's a lot of companies out there today, especially large publicly traded companies, that have some form of a sustainability index, and they're grading themselves on how sustainable they are. And I think there's not a lot of, you know, commonality. However, I believe NASDAQ has actually created the Sustainable 100, you know, the most 100 environmentally aware companies, and they've got a specific ranking criteria on how you're tracking that. So that could be applicable. It's an excellent question, and I think something that certainly should be considered as part of the benefit of these repurposing these sites.
Okay, that's great. And Tom, if people have follow-up questions, they have your email address. So thank you again for doing a great job. I think we're ready to move on now to our next speaker. I'm happy to introduce Dr. Vivian Valiance, who's going to talk about South Point. Vivian, you want to go ahead? I think we're on slide 34.
Yes.
And then, yes, okay.
Yes, thank you again for having me with you all today. I'm very proud of this site and the things that we've been through and the marathon that we had to run in order to get to where we are now. On to slide number 35, just a brief overview of our community. The tri-state region where we are located is where Kentucky, Ohio, and West Virginia come together on the Ohio River, and it has long been one of the nation's commercial and industrial manufacturing hubs. Unfortunately, though, in the early 1980s, we had faced a huge economic downturn. We, you know, a lot of our major employers, our major manufacturing companies, basically, and this isn't an exaggeration, they left overnight to go to an overseas operation or something a little less cost, that had a little less cost involved in it. And we were left with, I mean, we went from, in 1982, we went from an unemployment rate of 10 in January to an unemployment rate of over 21% by November of that year. So the community kind of came together because of our distressful situation, and in 1983, my agency was formed, the Lawrence Economic Development Corporation. And since then, our agency has brought together the state and some federal partners to collaborate on a region-wide economic revitalization of projects to reverse that 21% unemployment rate. And with that, you know, the Point Industrial Park, which I'll be discussing, has been a vital part of this effort. It's transforming former manufacturing facilities into an industrial park that now employs over 320 people and is providing over $12 million in annual income. The next slide, slide number 36. The picture there is actually the industrial site. We only own 504 acres of it. The industrial property is actually 610 acres. A little over 100 acres is owned by another entity, and we're not involved in their development. But the picture up there up top is the site in the early 1940s when it was a munitions plant. When it was a munitions plant, for our largest employer, not just for Lawrence County, but for all of southern Ohio and the tri-state area of Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia, they have thousands of employees, you know. Families talk about their great-grandfathers that worked there and their grandfathers that worked there. So it was a huge community driving force for our area here. And after it was a munitions plant, it went on to be a fertilizer and chemical manufacturing facility. And, you know, like I said, even though this facility employed thousands of people, it also gave us a huge pollution problem in the latter years. The site operations, waste materials, and four major releases contaminated the soil and groundwater with volatile and semi-volatile organic compounds, including ammonia, nitrates, and metals like arsenic and cadmium. And the EPA listed the site on the National Priorities List in September of 1984. Following a risk assessment and remedial investigation, the EPA selected a remedy in the site's 1997 Record of Decision. The agency determined that contaminants were either manufactured or disposed of at five specific site locations within the industrial park, and the majority of the site property was never contaminated. On to slide number 37, please. In talking about the site cleanup, of course, the picture up here now is the core of the industrial park where everything has been cleaned off. Not just above ground, but underground as well. There were some tanks and some other things that had to be removed as well. The site's remedy included digging up and disposing of contaminated soil, both on-site and off-site. We placed a cap over the site's eastern disposal area. If you're familiar with southern Ohio at all, that's the site that's visible off of US 52, heading north and south here at the edge of Ohio. Putting in place surface controls for the site's northern fly ash ponds, groundwater pumping, containment, monitoring, and discharge into the Ohio River, institutional controls that restrict the use of site groundwater and stipulate that the site can be used only for commercial and industrial purposes. Throughout all of these activities, the EPA was we worked very well with the EPA, and I know that, I don't know if Tom Bloom is on this call, but he worked with our agency. He was down here. He basically almost had an office here. We saw him so much. But they came down and met regularly with our agency and the community and some of our elected officials as well, and got some community feedback into exactly what the Superfund process was and what we could actually gain from it. So it was a huge learning curve for Lawrence County and the state of Ohio as well. The selected remedy enabled the site to be reused for commercial and industrial land uses, which the EPA had determined to be the site's reasonably anticipated future land use. The cleanup activities actually began in May of 2001, and the construction of the site's remedy was completed in December of 2001. In May 2011, 10 years, the EPA completed the second five-year review for the site. The five-year review concluded that our site remedy continues to be protective of human health and the environment. And on to page 38. To help lead the regional revitalization effort, our community had formed LEDC in 1983 as the local nonprofit community improvement corporation that focuses on job creation and retention. As the LEDC continued to work, the idea of developing a premier world-class industrial park made more and more sense to us because of the site's size and proximity to the highway, rail, and river infrastructure, and the availability of skilled labor force. Another interesting note, too, is where we're located in southern Ohio, we're pretty much landlocked. We are parallel to the Ohio River, and then we have the rolling hills of Ohio right above us. So we only have a little bit of land space that's available for industrial usage. So we have to remediate as much as we could, and the Point Industrial Park, of course, was our number one goal to remediate and get up and running and hire some employees. The LEDC worked closely with site staff from Region 5, as I said, Mr. Tom Bloom, and the Ohio EPA during these years, verifying the property's status as a Superfund site. The agency helped the community understand which areas of the site were not contaminated and potential reuse implications of the site's cleanup. LEDC helped the agencies understand the value of this site to the community for economic development, for earnings, for jobs and tax revenues, and for the long term. The EPA's 1997 record of decision, which selected the site remedy, concluded that it is reasonably anticipated that future use at the site will remain industrial. All told, the LEDC worked patiently with businesses and state and federal agencies for more than a decade, building relationships and putting economic development tools and resources in place. We actually acquired the site in 2001 for about $3.86 million through an empowerment zone loan and grant program that was created for us then. On to page 39. During the design of the site's cleanup, we were also able to work with the EPA and Honeywell International that enabled the use of on-site soils for the site's landfill cap. In return, Honeywell regraded those areas for redevelopment for us. And I'd also like to say that they've also been very helpful continuously to this day on redevelopment of those sites as well. Following the cleanup, our agency received reuse planning assistance from the EPA's Region 5 and the EPA Superfund Redevelopment Initiative in 2002. That assistance enabled the development of a toolkit of communication materials to address stigma and public safety concerns. In 2004, the EPA also developed a ready for reuse determination for our site. The report stated that the EPA had determined that the LEDC site property was ready for industrial reuse. As a result, by the end of 2004, two businesses had located at our industrial park, citing the industrial park's location, business incentives, and building availability, as well as the completed cleanup and ready for reuse determination for the South Point Superfund site as key factors in their decisions and relocating to the point. On to slide 40. Where we are now, we currently have 320 employees, and of course, like I said, we have over $12 million in annual employee income and over $85,000 in property taxes. Directly and indirectly, when our industrial park is completely built out, we could be actually, that 2,000 and 3,000 is pretty low. We actually did an economic impact study just last month, and it could be over 5,000 indirect and direct jobs because of our new multimodal system that we're currently developing. On to page 41, or slide 41. As I had said, there's over 320 employees in the Point now. Of those companies, those businesses include an industrial products distributor, an activated carbon and air water treatment system manufacturer, a metal products and processing provider, a parts fabrication and machine shop, a heating and cooling company, a direct mail marketing firm, an agricultural equipment specialist, a rail right-of-way maintenance company, and a shipbuilding and tugboat service company. We're also in the process of building a new rail spur that is located parallel to the Ohio River, which will give us the opportunity of being a true multimodal industrial park where we can move products off of the Ohio River onto rail or onto road or vice versa as needed. The Point Industrial Park's unique location along the Ohio River and along the Heartland Corridor, you know, this is actually the first part where the river and the Heartland Corridor meet. So we were marked by the Appalachian Regional Commission as one of a key point in the multimodal production in the Midwest. So we've been able to pull from that and get some grant funding from the state and federal government as well. And in the past 10 years, we've received over $30 million in funds to redevelop the site, to build buildings, and most recently, to build out our full multimodal system. So our industrial park will continue to play a vital role in the reestablishment of one of the country's preeminent industrial regions. When fully developed, like I said, we could support over 5,000 jobs within our 504-acre site. Slide 42. Some of the outcomes beside the, you know, the economic outcomes and the job creation and the building of new corporations or new manufacturing companies within the industrial park. As we created 320 jobs in less than 10 years, well, actually less than 6 years, from 2004 to 2010, we noticed that there was a lack of training. So we had these jobs and have these manufacturing companies coming into the Point and relocating in the Point, creating massive numbers of jobs, but we weren't sure if we had the skilled labor available. So what came into fruition was the Ohio University Business Training Center. Actually, this picture was taken, I think it was last month, but this month we've actually started a new partnership with Ohio University, of course, Lawrence Economic Development Corporation, and the state of Ohio and some of the other entities within our community to create and to broaden our reach. And we are now being called the Ohio Strategic Training Center. And with the training center, we've been able to go out and assess the needs of all of the businesses within the Point Industrial Park to see exactly where we fall short labor-wise and what we can do to help fill those positions. Our situation may be similar to some of the other areas in the Midwest where we're needing skilled labor, for example. So what we're doing now is we are bringing in some labor training and welding training into the Ohio Strategic Training Center in order to be able to provide the people and the skilled labor necessary to keep those companies here at the Point Industrial Park. The Point's industrial history and contamination was a huge concern for the university. Following meetings with LEDC and correspondence with the EPA and Ohio EPA, during which the parties reviewed the EPA's preliminary closeout report and ready to reuse determination for the South Point plant, the university determined that the agency's documentation of the site's contamination, remediation, and a current availability for industrial reuse were sufficient to move forward with the project. In its first year of operation, the training center held over 200 training services and had over 20 business clients. That was the first year. We're now well over the 200 mark. On to the next slide, slide number 43. Some of our redevelopment resources, I had mentioned that we have received over $30 million in funding from local, state, and federal firms. We've also had a lot of support from the community, the village of South Point and area localities helped to fund the extension of updated water and sewer infrastructure to the Point. State and federal designations provided critical dollars in the early development stages for acquisition and development costs, In 1999, the Point was designated as an Ohio Enterprise Zone and a non-contiguous developable site within the Huntington-Ironton Empowerment Zone. State and federal designations that provided the LEDC with $2.2 million in acquisition funds and a range of incentives to attract businesses to locate at the Point. In total, the Empowerment Zone has provided the Point and LEDC with $4.8 million in funding and enabled the Point to leverage an additional $8.5 million in public and private dollars. And finally, the LEDC received reuse planning assistance from the EPA's Region 5 and the EPA's Superfund Redevelopment Initiative in 2002. The assistance led to the development of several tools, including a ready for reuse determination that supported the site's reuse while also ensuring the protection of the community's health. Slide 44. Lessons learned. One of the biggest lessons learned, of course, is that, you know, something like this really takes time. It can take many years to remediate contamination that has accumulated over decades of site activities. However, that process also provides a time window for stakeholders to build partnerships and identify resources, coordinate with EPA and state agencies, and develop a strategy for returning a site to use while protecting future users. Our agency was formed in the early 1980s and worked for more than a decade to put into place the pieces needed to develop the Point Industrial Park. The South Point plant site was uniquely suited for industrial redevelopment in a region with significant industrial resources and infrastructure. Other Superfund sites may be suited for other types of land uses. As the organizations responsible for their community's general welfare, local governments are particularly well-positioned to host redevelopment projects, bring together diverse stakeholders to discuss site reuse opportunities, and use planning tools and incentives to foster positive site outcomes. The next slide. Considerations of future land use opportunities can help inform both cleanup plans and the implementation of site remedies. At the Point Industrial Park South Point plant site, the EPA developed a remedy that recognized that the site would likely be used for industrial land uses in the future. In South Point, the EPA understood the community's priorities in the context of the site's cleanup, supporting the community's reuse efforts while emphasizing a timely site cleanup. The EPA also provided tools and resources to support the Superfund site reuse. The agency's Ready for Reuse determination for the site has been integral to the LEDC's efforts to attract businesses to the Point. And lastly, LEDC worked with the previous site owner. Actually, we continue to work with Ashland, Inc. to acquire the land needed for the Point, and we're actually in negotiations with some other areas as well to extend not only just from the 504-acre site into a much larger site. And that's basically the end of my presentation.
Well, Vivian, I want to thank you very much. That was so interesting. And let me ask you a question. Is this site deleted currently?
I don't think it has been officially deleted.
Okay. It's just I ask because it's a contrast to the site we just heard about from Tom at ReVenture. And so obviously people are looking at deletion in a different way. So it is possible to have a redevelopment if a site is not deleted. Do we have anybody on the phone who has some questions for Vivian? Okay. All right, great. And remember, we'll have an opportunity at the end to ask more questions. But why don't we move on to our final case study, VERTAC? And I'll turn everything over to Jay Whisker. Jay, go ahead.
All right. Thank you so very much. We're talking about VERTAC here in Jacksonville, Arkansas, just outside of Little Rock. If you're familiar with the Little Rock, we're central Arkansas. And we're 30,000 for about the 500,000 people that live here in the area. Next slide, please, 48. The land here that started Jacksonville was originally a ordnance plant with munitions, and after the war it was separated out. In the late 50s they went ahead and created Little Rock Air Force Base out of some of the land, and then the other lands ended up going to be manufacturing facilities, and over the next 50s through the 80s it became several different plants, And in this particular instance, they created Agent Orange. It in turn created dioxin, and we ended up on the EPA list in September of 1983. This led to a whole series of discussions between local and state government. How could this happen? And of course, we had elections, and in 1987, Mayor Swaim was elected as the mayor for Jacksonville. He, in turn, promised that he would have the site cleaned up within his four-year term. And interestingly enough, he did, next slide, please. Interestingly enough, he did end up having it cleaned up. It just took him 12 years to do so. On September 1st of 1998, we ended up being declared site cleanup and had a big ceremony in City Hall. On the other side, for the cleanup, we had our current mayor, Mayor Fletcher, long-standing alderman, was upset with the way it was going to get cleaned up. So he actually called then Governor Governor Clinton to discuss with him what was going on. They actually had daughters the same age. Governor Clinton's obviously was Chelsea and Mayor Fletcher's, and he called him late at night. He called him early during the day, and the governor called him late back at night and said, by the way, you know, your daughter goes out and plays, you know, and sees state troopers. Well, mine goes out and sees moon suits. We really don't want to have the incineration on site. We want it off site. So after talking with the governor, they, of course, had on site incineration. And you can see the vault here that is located on site, on the city site. Well, not on the city site, pardon me, on the site still owned by Vertec, which is described as Lot 1. Next slide, please. There were many buildings that were left on site, this being one of them. And what happened was the incineration was going on. They built the buildings to help do this, put the barrels in different places, and they left them there. So then part of the reuse of the plan was, well, let's talk about taking the barrels and putting them on a different location, or the, not the barrels, pardon me, the ash from the burn-off, put them in a different location, and then let's see if there's some revitalization we can do with the buildings that are on site. So acquisition of the parcel was started around 2000 because property taxes, and as you can see in 1987, they stopped paying property taxes, and as it continued to go, the land commissioner had trouble trying to sell the land for the taxes owed, so the city acquired the property in about 2000. If you go to the next slide, slide 51. We actually had an old ordnance plant where we had started a recycling center, and in the recycling center, what was the first drive-through recycling center, where you actually drove your truck in and we would have employees and or trustees to help unload the recycling so that you could drive through, not even get out of your truck, and continue on. The building had fallen into disrepair, and so the mayor decided to use the first building closest to the road as the recycling center. So you can see it here as it's been reconstructed. We actually have partnered currently with Pulaski County Solid Waste District. They help man the booth, and so not only do we have recycling just for the city's part with cardboard, paper, and aluminum, we also are able to take materials there on site, use motor oil and that type of thing, so that we can recycle for the rest. Next slide, please. Once we realized that the land was available and had so much property to it, we looked into what we were going to do in order to do the rest of the land. There was some monies there with the SRI, as previously discussed, funding, and we went through and did a study on what exactly we could do for that area. Some of the things that came up were police and fire training facilities. We wanted to relocate several city departments. They wanted always more green space, and then city infrastructure, as you can see on the list right there. The city has been in different pieces and parts as cities grow. Of course, they kind of use the old building, and then they move to another building and continue to use the old building. And so there was some hodgepodge there, and so there was some relocation that we really wanted to get everybody on the same page. This study helped to do that and really helped kind of lead the way on where we wanted to go. Next slide, we're on 53. As you can see the site, we ended up with eight different facilities, the street department, a driving pad, which is the center square there, number two, the burn tower for the fire department so they could practice their burns, controlled burning. Four is the public safety building there near the road. Five is the police fire range in the back. 6 is the city storage. That's usually what we use for most of the recycling. When it comes in, we actually bundle it, and depending on pricing, whether it be low or high, we're able to put it back there until the prices get better, and then we can sell it all at once. With the drive-through recycling center there, number 7, and then the recycling education park that we built there on the front, which is number 8. That's the site, as you can see, the site that's cleared off is that's the site that's parcel 2 that we own. If you'll see the site down to the south area, down towards Hill Road, that is enclosed and still owned by the Vertec. Next slide, if you go to 54. This is a close-up of the new 3,004-square-foot burn tower. Stands 4 stories tall due to the regulations that we needed. The whole tower itself, actually the structure of it is encased in metal, and the actual walls and whatnot are cinder block, but the structure itself is what stands, and as it goes through the whole life cycle of the building through all the different burns, it actually can be taken down and rebuilt with the block, still leaving the structure in place, which helps give a cost to every burn so that as we do this, we know how much we're charging, how much we're costing for each and every burn. And then we're also offering to let other departments use this, of course, at a cost to make sure we can rebuild it. Right now, our current location for a fire tower is approximately 100 miles away in south-central Arkansas, and this gives us a tremendous opportunity to continue to not only practice and do it right here, but there's no cost for going out, and so it is a definite money saver to the city, and then also brings people from other communities not too far away who can train on it, and then others who don't or can't get all the way down to south Arkansas can come to central Arkansas, stay in our hotels, eat the food, you know, and have an economic impact for us that way. So this has been a really nice addition for us. Next slide. This is the police firing range. This was new to us as well. It much bigger than the old one. It currently, we had a berm in an older part of town that we used. This supplies us with not only shooting ranges, shooting lanes for the different depths of what it needs. It has a stationary target area, it has a moving and tactical department area, and it's got a indoor area, climate controlled, where you can watch the targets, move the targets, and help take care of that. It's got lights for if there's any nighttime activities to have it safe in that time. And it's also got a rifle range to one side for even further distance. And then you can see that in the top right-hand picture. If you look, you'll see the lane all the way over to the far left. That's the rifle area right there. Next slide. The recycling and education park, really, you know, you open the recycle center, the first part of it, which was the drive-through, and I think it really brings home the statement that, you know, even though this is an EPA Superfund site, you know, the city is going to turn something that's had a negative image, which absolutely stopped the city's growth for 10 years, into something that can be beautiful and start again. And that was really the starting point. And as we made that and we've made these rounds, the education park then became the next piece really to help people understand what's going on, not just with recycling education, but of course, you know, you can make that to a broader concept of we're building this into a better city. This education park shelter was put up approximately 4 or 5 years ago. Has a walking track around it. It actually has art pieces made of recycled metals. And then it has different stations. You can see in the right-hand picture, you can see the Union Pacific Railroad car wasn't going to be used anymore. We brought it in and made it a place for kids to climb on. So as you can see, we're really trying to do all the right things with the recycling part of this to make sure not only that school kids get it, but that the community knows that we're redoing what was once something that was a problem for us into something that is good. If you go to the next slide, please. That'll be slide number 57. We've built onto the street department the biggest building in the back. Obviously, the one we had the most vehicles with was the street department, so they've turned that into their area. Street includes not only street, but it also includes striping and some garage. We've taken that and made that the building that's existing there into mostly parking for our trucks underneath. And then we have not only that, but as you can see in the right-hand corner, we have classrooms, kitchen, and offices in that area. Because as you know, anytime there's an emergency, you've got to have that place where you can take care of that. They've somewhat turned that into their area of operation during ice and snow removal. So it's been a nice addition to the city in there. If you go to the next slide, number 58, this slide was taken at or near the top of the fire tower. You're looking down at the new public safety building. This particular building started out as kind of the classrooms for the area, so that you could have a classroom for the burn tower. You could have a classroom for the driving pad, which is used for not only police but public works and for fire trucks. And so this was going to be the classroom, and then you could turn around and have the practical out kind of back behind it. What it turned into, because we had so many needs with police and 911 and classrooms, we've turned out to go ahead and put them all into one big building. A lot of funding was used to do this, and what it's going to turn into is funding from 911, funding from Arkansas Department of Emergency Management for a safe room, for people who need tornado shelters, and then we've actually had to borrow some money. We're turning this into a 37,000-foot building that's going to house our police department, our emergency operations center, our 911 center, and a community safe room for the people who need one in the area. Those familiar with Arkansas, we have a tornado problem. Apparently, we like to have them, and so this gives them a shelter to come to for those who don't have any. Go to the next slide, please, number 59. The drive-through recycling center, as you can read the numbers here, provides $50,000 worth of saving just in the landfill tipping fees. It employs 20 people. The recycling education park, we have many field trips go through there. The city street employs 20 people. Police has around 85. Fire has around 50. And then also mentioned in here, the ISO rating, this fire tower, training tower, we also were going through our ISO ratings, and it turned out that this helped us go from a 3 to a 2, which is anywhere between a 3 and 4% decrease in your fire insurance. So we're saving the citizens money on their insurance by giving them this. And then, of course, the public safety building, the 911, has about 20 people that work in it. So as far as we look at it from an economic standpoint for us, we do have employees here, but what it does do is attract and retain people who want a good working environment and a nice working area, and it also, in turn, also saves our citizens some money. If you go to the next slide, slide 60, these were some of the things that we had to get the building and the whole land together. We had a one-time sales tax that actually was for four different things, one of them being a police and fire training ground and the training center. Keep America Beautiful also has a Keep Arkansas Beautiful and a Keep Jacksonville Beautiful. And through those grants, we were able to do a lot of the statues and a lot at the recreation park, at the reuse park. So it's very nice there. We've had private citizens give through the Citizens Police Academy, FEMA through the ADEM Safe Room Grant. We have 911 phone fees because we put 911 in here. We've gotten those. And then, of course, the loans that we needed to complete it. If you go to the next page, 61. These are some of the things that are still on site, not on our site, but the site located right next to us. They have groundwater extraction wells, deed restrictions, the landfill is an area that's isolated, and believe it or not, the landfill being kind of back there was to help so it wasn't near kind of the main road, and we could grow trees and things around it so it was more isolated, kind of on the back of the property, away from others. If you go to slide 62, once again, I probably covered this earlier. It is a source of pride for us to have the new recycling center. It's on Marshall Road. The road that it's on, Marshall, is a four-lane road that leads from City Hall to Little Rock Air Force Base, which, as you can probably know, is a very busy road and is kind of a front area for us. To have the recycling center out there, to have it look like it does, is an immense prideful thing for our city versus what it used to be with chain link and grass growing up and bushes growing through it. We now have something we can look at and be proud of and know we're not only taking in and saving from the landfill, but we're making money back at it. Not enough to cover it, of course, but we're going to do it regardless because it's the right thing to do. Looking towards the future, if you'll go to slide 63, is the city's going to continue to do this. We're going to continue to work and grow. Once the public safety facility's in, there's still a piece of ground kind of to the north that is open for an area that we could have maybe another city business in there, maybe water or sewer. It's open at this point. But the recycle park and the recycling center is only going to do better and more. And I think that what you're going to see with us having this, I think you're going to see employee retention for the police and fire go up, and they're going to stay longer. I believe that you're going to see that it's just going to get better. Are there any questions? Slide 64 is the end.
Well, Jay, I want to thank you. That was a tremendous presentation, and I'm so happy that you were able to share with us everything that's going on. I guess I have the first question, and that is, you know, how did you arrive at your vision for redevelopment? When you started out, you know, everybody starts out, it's a Superfund site, and I guess you can either walk away or get upset, or you can sort of look forward and see what can be done. So tell us a little bit about your process and what happened, how you realized there was something else we could do.
Mayor Swain really was the mayor, the visionary. He was the one who started this, started the cleanup, and near the end, I think he realized that there was a possibility that he could use this land for some industrial purpose. And the more he looked into it, the more he realized that the industry he needed to have was the city of Jacksonville, and to keep it moving forward. So he got the department heads together from the police, fire, public works, and engineering office to start talking about what they needed in order to keep their departments moving forward in a positive manner. And the plan that you see with the driving pad and the police shooting range, the new police station, the fire burn tower, where there's also a draft pond back behind that we didn't highlight but's back there to help test the pumps on the trucks. So all these things lead to bettering our forces without having to go anywhere. And then not only that, but once again, the economic development is you attract others to you in those same departments.
That's great. Let me ask if there are any questions anybody has on the phone. Okay, and Jay, I know you'll be available by email if people want to contact you. Does anybody have any general questions about, we do have a question there? Let's see. Oh, we've got a question. Okay, let's see. As an environmental consulting firm heavily involved in remediation of Superfund sites, what are your recommendations in how to persuade our private sector clients to transfer a property over to redevelopment, going beyond the principles of sustainability, stewardship, positive economic impact, and improved community relations? How do you show that redevelopment helps their company's bottom line? Jay, you want to start with that, and then maybe we can ask Tom and Vivian if they have something to add?
I'd like to know, even when we had a cleaned up site, I don't think we could have gotten anybody to take it at that point because the perception was so negative. I think now you're starting to see the switch with Tom and his presentation. I think you're starting to see people who are smarter, who know there are ways to help figure to redo the land. But at the time that this was happening, I don't think that there was.
Okay. Vivian, do you want to add anything to that? Okay. Or Tom?
Sure. So can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So the question, how do you persuade companies to do something with the sites? I would say we found very effective the concept of risk transfer. Those companies have those sites. They typically don't want anything to happen on them because they don't want to open up, you know, Pandora's box and create more liabilities, what a lot of those folks, companies live in fear of. If you can find a company that will do the risk transfer structure and they can get that liability off of their books, I think that's an important mix to bring to the table. And, you know, if there's a thin layer of folks that actually do the risk transfer arbitrage, if you will, but That's certainly a key ingredient. If you had that in your portfolio, I think you'd create a lot of opportunities.
Thanks, Tom. That's good. Actually, that question is, we spend all our time thinking about it. How can we sort of show people what redevelopment is capable of and how it can help? So that's, I don't know that there's an easy answer to that question, but I think our panelists today have really helped us see that there is life after Superfund. And also, I just want to make the point one more time that what we're doing is we're not necessarily doing this redevelopment because the site is deleted. A lot of this redevelopment has occurred if the site has not been deleted. So I don't want that somebody to think that that's always a stopper. So let me just ask one more time if we have any other questions on the phone or on, I don't see any more online, but on the phone if anybody has anything. Okay, great. In that case, I want to thank our panelists very much. I thought this was a really interesting discussion, and I'm so pleased to hear about everything that's been going on. And our panelists have indicated they're available. If anybody has any questions, you can email them directly, or you can email me or Frank Avasato. I'm going to turn it over to Michelle Mahoney now, who will tell you how we need to close out the session.
Sure, yeah, and I just want to echo what Melissa said. Thank you, everyone, for a great presentation. Thank you, all of our participants, for your attention, and I would like to direct you to our last slide of the presentation, which is slide 66. And here you'll find the links to additional resources that I mentioned at the beginning of our presentation, along with a feedback form where you can give us your comments and feedback on today's webinar and any ideas for future sessions. We will take a look at those. So if you could just take a moment to fill that out, we would really appreciate that. And with that, I think we've had a successful webinar, and thank you, everyone, for your attention. And you will be receiving an email when the archive is available. So thank you, everyone, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks again.